Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of futures. At Janus Henderson, we are committed to helping you invest in a brighter future for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Tuesday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer and David Faber. Futures are off the morning lows as the reopening trade hits a bit of a speed bump. The U.S. calling for a pause in the J&J vaccine. Regulators hold a press conference in an hour. Meantime, inflation hawks dodge a bullet. March core CPI hot by 1/10 at 1.6 year on year. Our roadmap begins with that J&J pause. Federal health agencies making the recommendation following rare blood clot cases after the single dose vaccine.
Plus, we'll look into the potential pause fallout, just what the impact of vaccine of this will be on vaccine hesitancy, reopening timelines, and, of course, that trade involving stay-at-home stocks. And we've got the world's largest SPAC merger. Yeah, SoftBank backed Grab agrees to go public in a deal that's worth nearly $40 billion. Carl.
All right, guys, we'll get straight to the news out of the FDA this morning, as well as a statement, Jim, from J&J, in which they say we continue to work closely with experts and regulators to assess the data. But at present, no clear causal relationship has been established between those rare events and the Janssen vaccine.
Well, look, I think that there are two themes here. One is that this is going to pause the reopening. And the second is really what happens when you take this? And I want to point out that when you just go get the flu vaccine, forget this, the flu vaccine, there are people who die from the flu vaccine every year. And it's taken by far fewer than what we expect here. Don't forget, J&J only had about 4 million doses that it was able to give to this country. They were coming from the Netherlands, and that's because the J&J vaccine was being made by Emergent Bio. Emergent Bio's had its systems literally taken over by J&J in the Baltimore factory. So I want to emphasize that Moderna and Pfizer are going to fill in, and I want to hear what the FDA has to say, and it's obviously terrible for the people who have had this, obviously, the blood cut situation. But, David, what I see this as is it is a speed bump. Not more than that. And J&J had pretty much, let's just say, been relegated to almost an asterisk, given their facts that they've had such problems at an Emergent Bio facility.
Yeah, I mean, Moderna and Pfizer's vaccine have been by far the most prevalent, the first on the market, and continue to be given at, thankfully, rapid rates. But, you know, Jim, listen, we'll defer to the experts, of course. We'll have Meg coming up in a moment as well to fill us in. But give me your take. I mean, 6.8 million doses of the vaccine have been administered in the U.S., and there are six cases of this blood clot called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. It's one in a million. Is that typical in your experience?
Yes, that's the one in a million, according to the WHO for the flu, WHO for the flu vaccine. And I just have to tell you, I mean, I think that we haven't pulled the flu vaccine because it has that exact, you know, kind of the exact same numbers. Now, obviously, look, we don't want anyone to have a blood clot. And we obviously just expect everybody to do well. But you know what? If you look at what vaccine I have taken every single year, I expect that there's there's a possibility that I could get sick from the regular vaccine. This is kind of the same ratio. So, Carl, before we really just panic, there'll be people who take the flu vaccine every year, and that's the number that, that's the number that people die from. I mean, that's literally the number. And I want to emphasize that people still take the flu vaccine, so I don't think this is going to be the, obviously bad for J&J momentarily, but I don't think it's going to hurt the rollout of the nation's vaccine program at all, Carl. Not at all.
Yeah. No, I mean, we should remind viewers that COVID-19 itself creates blood clots in severe cases. 11% of severe cases have deep vein thrombosis. By the way, Jim, to your point about how fortunate we are that supply ex-J&J is so healthy, New York State's got a tweet right now saying that all appointments today in New York State that were going to be J&J will simply be filled with the Pfizer vaccine.
Right. Right. I mean, look, J&J screwed up. All right. They outsourced their product to Emergent Bio. Emergent Bio's had many, many problems. It's been a real bad move to make it so that Emergent Bio was making their vaccine. So they had to import what they had, what they could from the Netherlands, which is about 4 million doses. I mean, I think that J&J was on pause. All right. And so now they're really on pause. And it's a shame. There are a lot of people who have taken the J&J. I think that the ratio is not bad at all. But anybody, of course, who dies is terrible. But can we just say that J&J was not going to be a factor to begin with? And Pfizer and Moderna are in full speed ahead mode. Terrible for anyone who got hurt from J&J or died. One person died. But Pfizer and Moderna are ready. And I don't think this halts anything. David, once again, people want to take the vaccine.
Well, but that becomes the question. Does this in some way play into those who are hesitant to begin with, even though it's one in a million? And as you said, one death out of 6.8 million doses administered here in the U.S. Nonetheless, does that play into fears that perhaps some in the population have about getting the vaccine? We know that there is hesitancy to begin with, Jim, and we do need a large percentage of people to get vaccinated as quickly as possible. I mean, I'm somewhat stunned sometimes when you see some of the numbers of certain cohorts. I think it was even the military, right? Did you see the numbers? Like the Marines and things of that nature?
Yes. Sort
40%. Of shocking.
40%, right, Carl? I mean, that's a shockingly high number of people who said, no, thank you, at least now. It's unclear to me that this doesn't hurt the ability to change their minds.
Well, we're still at 3.2 million yesterday. I think that there are a lot of people who just accepted the fact that they were going and getting some vaccine. I now think that people will say, listen, I want the Pfizer. I want the Moderna. I don't want anything else. But they'll continue to ask because I think that you're going to get it. Look, we have no natural defense against this illness. If you decide that you don't want a vaccine, you're going to get it. I mean, that's pretty much what's going to happen, especially with this new rapid fire illness, the one that's been imported. Carl, if you know you're going to get something, I mean, it's your choice is this. You're going to either take the vaccine, which is Moderna and Pfizer, of which we have no real instances of anyone doing anything but being sick at the second Moderna, or you're going to get sick with you're going to get sick with COVID-19. That's your options. There's no other option. Because this thing, we have no natural defense. Can we just accept that and just say, well, some people are asymptomatic? But, Carl, I'm not buying this idea. I don't want this fact. I do not want this illness. I don't think anyone wants this illness. They're going for Moderna. They're going for Pfizer. Back to you.
Jim, don't go too far. We're going to obviously find out what the regulators say, we think, at 10 a.m. Eastern time. And in the meantime, we'll check in with Meg Terrell this morning, talk about what she knows. And I guess, Meg, the degree to which you're surprised, there had been some on the street, at least. Goldman's a good example from last November that did sort of spell out a downside scenario on J&J because of safety issues and even AZN as well.
Yeah, it's certainly an evolving situation right now. We've been following the situation with AstraZeneca in Europe very closely, and it was only on Friday that European regulators signaled they were looking into four cases of blood clots with the J&J vaccine, three of which were reported from the United States, including one death. Now, we checked in with the FDA on Friday, and they said they were looking into these themselves. As of today, the statement we have seen from the FDA and CDC, a joint statement, notes there have been six of these cases of extremely rare blood clots among 6.8 million vaccinations with the J&J vaccine in the United States. So these are rare and severe blood clots. It's a combination of a blood clot with a low platelet level. So it has a very specific profile in terms of what to look for. It's not just a normal blood clot. Now, in terms of the symptoms that they note, they see them within 3 weeks of the, we should also note they're, all six of these cases occurred in women ages 18 to 48. The symptoms occurred within 6 to 13 days after vaccination. And they are putting this out to let doctors know you don't treat this with heparin the normal way you might treat blood clots. Alternative treatment is required here because heparin might actually be something that you don't want to give. And in terms of what folks should be looking out for, even though this is exceedingly rare, they say within 3 weeks of vaccination, if anyone feels severe headache, abdominal pain, leg pain, or shortness of breath, they should let their doctors know. Now, guys, you were talking about that statement from J&J earlier. They do note there is no link that has been definitively proven here. No causal relationship has been established, they say, between these rare events and the J&J COVID-19 vaccine. They say they're working with regulators and they are looking at this themselves. And again, we'll hear at 10 a.m. from the FDA about more about their investigations here and how they're looking at this. And then tomorrow, the CDC's advisory committee will meet and have a meeting and have a discussion about all of the data and try to figure out the best way forward, guys. But six events out of more than 6 million vaccinations, it's very rare. They want to make sure they understand the risk benefit, guys.
Meg, I find this news, let's just say, capricious. Because 274 people, Brian Sullivan and I going back on this, 274 people die each day of clotting. COVID causes clotting. J&J, let's just say, have been very successful with its vaccine. If you look at, say, the NJ.com today, there's one person who got COVID after they got after the J&J vaccine, and that was newsworthy. So can we just accept that it may not be the panic cause that a lot of people are making this, Meg?
Certainly. It's really difficult to evaluate risk. You know, we hear about something like this and it sounds really scary. The risk from getting COVID is really bad, too. We've become used to that risk of COVID. And so a lot of folks will say the way we think about risk benefit for ourselves is not always the way we actually should in reality think about what poses the biggest risk to us. But you know, what a lot of folks I'm seeing say this morning are saying is that the FDA is taking this really seriously. And in some ways, we should be reassured by how careful the regulators are being about six cases of these rare blood clots, ensuring they understand the risk benefit for different populations. This is what we saw Europe do for the AstraZeneca vaccine, too, so that people can really feel confident in the system that what the FDA puts its stamp on really means it's safe and effective. David?
Yeah, of course, as we said, it may have the opposite effect, given the numbers are so small. Meg, thank you. Obviously, we'll pay very close attention to your continued reporting on this developing story this morning. Meg Terrell. Guys, did want to hit before we hit a quick break. The largest SPAC deal we've seen to date, just back to the market overall this morning. It is the Asian, Southeast Asian online food delivery, ride hailing, financial services company Grab. It's growing very quickly, as you might anticipate. It's an enormous deal, valuing the company at just under $40 billion. It's going public via SPAC with Altimeter Growth Corp. This had been reported previously as a likely deal for that SPAC. And so we'll keep an eye on the shares this morning. They are up a bit, but you can see it already may have reflected to a certain extent the expectations for this being the deal. It's a $4 billion pipe. With another $750 million coming from Altimeter. They're also committing to a three-year lockup on their SPAC shares itself that they're getting. Other investors, BlackRock, Fidelity, the usual group that you often see in these pipes. But, Jim, what's interesting here as well is it wasn't more than, I think, just months ago that this was valued at half the level it's going public at. To give you some sense as the excitement, at least, that some in the SPAC world are viewing some of these opportunities. They're willing to say, okay, yeah, we'll double that. We'll double that and take you public. And we'll be keeping a close eye on those shares.
Well, why don't they just completely screw up the market with this? I mean, this is beginning to become, look, I do like the Coinbase deal. Look, real company. But I want to hear this at $40 billion. I mean, why don't we just arbitrarily make up just ridiculous prices? I mean, I think Grab could be very interesting because, wow, it's like it's an Asian Uber. But I just hear it's like, David, you can't just double the valuation based on what? What happened at the company that it got doubled? Tell me, David.
I don't have an answer for you. And I think that's the appropriate question to be asking at this point. Obviously, Brad Gerstner, who's a frequent guest with Scott Wapner at noon on Halftime, is a very well-respected investor. And look at that. I didn't even know. I just mentioned his name, and he's coming on again today. Well, who knew?
Well, they're making $50 billion. I'm going to make it $50 billion
because
he's going to be really impressive.
I'm sure you'll
get 50. How do you have 50? How about 60? Do I get 60 in the corner? I got 70 in the back.
You'll get very articulate answers from him as to why this makes sense. Listen, there's no doubt this is going to be a leader. It's a huge potential market over there. But Jim, that's the key question. And Carl, and will continue to be. We'll watch the shares again. As I said, they had already had a move up to a certain extent.
I got $75 billion on the phone, David. I got $75 billion on the phone. Back to you. Check to you. Check to you.
I hear Archegos may want to corner the market in these shares. So who knows where it could go?
Oh.
Ooh, yeah.
Do they actually have SpongeBob, too? They got SpongeBob? NFL?
No, they don't. They don't. But they like it. They like it. Yeah, you never know.
But is it, how about not? Is it non-token? Is it, is it for the, never mind.
It's non-fungible token delivered to your house.
NFT, yeah, okay.
Guys, we'll wait to see what Brad says on the half later on today. In the meantime, quick break. We'll get to March CPI, talk about what inflation numbers told us this morning. Want to get Jim's reaction to NVIDIA's Analyst Day yesterday, this new war with Intel. And that Coinbase call out of Moffitt as they go to buy on this initiation with a target of 600. Back in a moment.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system up to a 313-mile range and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Got a new record high for Bitcoin this morning. It surpasses 63K. Earlier this morning, as you know, best performing asset of Q1. The surge comes a day before Coinbase is set to direct list on the NASDAQ, Jim. And now this Moffitt call, as we keep our eyes open for initiations, they go to buy 600 and they say proven profitability, but not for the faint of heart.
Well, I think Lisa Ellis is excellent. She was one of the first people to get wise to the idea that Square is more than just a Cash App. Square's got the way you can buy Bitcoin in slices. I think that her piece on Coinbase is excellent, and it's really focused on the scarcity issue. Now, there are going to be people all day who say, you know what, I'd rather own Bitcoin than I would own a stock. No, that's just not true. What you really rather own is a stock that is scarce, that people want, that is really the king of the area. And that's what I just think this thing could explode. Now, here's one where I think that $92 billion private value is too low, Carl. I think it goes much higher.
Wow. Much higher, Jim.
Yeah.
Why?
I do.
I mean, listen, I'm reading through the Moffitt-Nathanson report that Carl mentioned. 90% roughly of their core business at this point is driven by retail trading and cryptocurrencies, primarily in the U.S., and they do believe that this is sort of going to be a peak year for that for some time.
Right. That is the issue. And by the way, even when you read the documents on Coinbase, they do talk about the possibility that it's a peak issue. I just feel like what's happened is, first, Fred Wilson, old friend of mine, is involved, and he's a very, very smart guy. He did TheStreet.com with me. I just look at this thing and I say, give me something that is encompassing all of these different currencies. All of these different cryptos, but not just Bitcoin, because I got a feeling that Ethereum is going to be in fire because Ethereum is the way you buy these non-fungible tokens, David. And if they do take off, you're going to want to have something that has all of these. I think that therefore it will become the de facto way to trade them in the stock market. Right now, we only have Square. So, David, I think it's just one of those notions, and Lisa correctly talks about this, where people just say, okay, I need something in my portfolio that is crypto. Give me some of this. This company's a real good company. And it is, by the way. It's a totally legitimate good company. So it's going to become the de facto way for stock people. Put it in their portfolio, including a lot of portfolio managers who feel like they can't put crypto in their actual portfolios.
Right.
Carl, I think that therefore, look, here's what's going to happen. It's a direct listing. I don't know if there's going to be enough stock this time to sate what I think will be individuals who buy it. Do I think it should be as high as it's going to be? No, it's going to be over-enthusiastic, Carl. At the same time, the scarcity value does make it seem like that there is a huge bull case, and Lisa Ellis makes it. She's a believer in crypto, and remember, we all felt that Square was worth far less, and look what they did. I just think that it's going to be a natural for a lot of portfolio managers.
Now, they do point out, Moffitt does, Jim, that they would be looking for, in their words, dramatic, potentially protracted swings. It doesn't sound like you necessarily disagree with that.
No, I don't. And when I look at Bitcoin right now, is that the possibility that thing goes down after this deal is priced, I think, is pretty big. And you know what? Look, these direct listings, I mean, just talk about another gimmick that's hard to game. I mean, is it Palantir that doubles? Is it Roblox? Could it be that? I mean, I love Roblox. Hey, could it be Google, which came public in 88? All I know is that it's going to be very confused. And, Carl, confusion leads to overvaluation, not undervaluation.
Yeah, tomorrow's going to be big, guys. We'll take a quick break here as we get set for a Tuesday morning open in about 9 minutes. Don't go away.
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
We led with the J&J news this morning, obviously. Inflation turned out to be, I guess, more of a non-event than some inflation hawks might have expected. Core CPI up 1.6. We were looking for 1.5. Headlines still the hottest since 2018 year on year, but yields did tick lower on the news. We're back in a minute.
Welcome back. Time for a Mad Dash, and then we'll get you to the opening bell. Amazon shares trailing the broader market by a good amount so far in their performance this year, Jim.
Yeah, David, a lot of people feel that it's going to lapse some very difficult comparisons, not unlike Costco, which, of course, then turned to blow away the numbers with an 11% comp versus very big pantry stocking last year. Okay, so Jefferies comes on with a path. David, it's not a path to 4,700. It's not a path to 5,000. It's a path to 5,700. And how has that arrived at? Well, some of it is your friend SOTP, which is the sum of the parts. I don't think anyone really expects to be broken up. But it's Amazon Web Services. And they're talking about that thing could be worth $1.25 trillion in 3 years. Well, you know what? Talk about an undervalued asset buried within this company. And also, this is the advertising should explode. Yep. I want to add also that the unionization failed in Alabama. David, I think that Amazon is about to make up its underperformance, and this Jefferies note is going to really start igniting people talking about it again.
So interesting. Yeah, we talk often about, of course, the profitability of Amazon Web Services and the advertising business, which the numbers of which are getting to be very, very large, and the margins on which are very, very strong, as opposed to, of course, what we all know Amazon for, the retail business, where costs are very significant.
Yeah, look, advertising's big. Don't forget, they're doing very well in Prime Video. And David, one of the things that I think is pretty amazing here is that core retail, they say, is the long-term beneficiary. But what they didn't talk about is Adam Selipsky. Selipsky is Mr. King of this kind of data, and he moved over from Salesforce back to Amazon, which is to me means that those who are worried that Andy Jassy, when he goes up to be the CEO, that somehow Amazon Web Services might skip a beat. No! I think that you own this for consumer packaged goods, advertising, and you own it for AWS. You own it because I think that it's going to prove to be a much lower long-term value because of Prime Video. Own Amazon. Don't trade it.
Well, we'll see how it
Amazon,
does here at the Belgium as the reopening trade. You might think there might be some money flowing back into AMZ, and there is the opening bell in the NYSE at the Nasdaq. By the way, Jim, Morgan Stanley's got a list of 12 high conviction names this morning, where they think there's a catalyst that will drive shares materially higher in the next, I think it's 15 to 60 days. Amazon's one of them, along with Caesars, Schwab, Halliburton, RealReal, and a few others.
Wow. Okay. Eclectic group, which pretty much, I think, stands for the fact that of every stock going up. Look, I think that we're going to have to watch Coinbase. If Coinbase goes bad, it could be like Uber. What does go bad? Means that there really isn't any depth to what it opens at, and it goes down from there. That's what I'm waiting to see. Otherwise, look, I see you get that inflation number. That didn't disturb the bond market. You have the bond market with not a lot of trepidation. But I'm more worried about things like Taiwan. I'm more worried about the exotic events. Like, what are the Chinese going to do? Are they going to disrupt the supply of chips even further? That's what I'm watching. And I know, David, when you say you watch Taiwan, people can say, well, you know, what are you going to do? Base your thinking like North Korea or Iran? I don't know. I'm a little concerned. I mean, how can you not be? They just flew 25 planes over it. Taiwan is integral to our supply chain. So, David, if it's what the administration's focused on, I think it would be a mistake not to focus on.
Yeah, well, obviously, you talk about it a great deal in terms of chip supply lately, but you're also talking just in terms of geopolitical tumult, I guess, Jim. You know, coming back to chips, and I know you covered this yesterday, I assume on MAD, there's NVIDIA and Intel at the top. Both are down, but NVIDIA, of course, unveiling a chip that's going to be used in data centers that's going to be many times faster than what is currently the case. What are they calling it? Grace? And Intel shares suffering yesterday in part as a result of that announcement. What's your take?
Well, look, Jensen Huang was on fire yesterday. He did his presentation with his telltale leather jacket, but it was done from his kitchen. He was unstoppable. Unstoppable because he basically just said, listen, we're going to upend everything. We're going to upend, driverless cars. Going to upend the data center. Going to upend gaming. He's talking about everyone being a gamer. His gaming comments are just incredible how big it's going to be. But in the end, yes, he's saying, look out, Intel. Intel owns 90% of that CPU market. And he's coming in. NVIDIA's coming in with a chip that could be 10 times what anybody has in terms of power. And immediately, they have a deal, it sounds like, with Amazon Web Services, which, of course, is Mr. Cloud. So I thought that this was a remarkable performance. I want everyone to kind of, you can go over it. It's not a long analyst day. But the numbers that they're talking about, 436 million people gaming. The fact that they have much less, their lowest latency. It sounds like if you game, you must use NVIDIA. And they have an Ethereum chip. I don't know. They got something for everybody, David. So I think NVIDIA ends up going higher, not lower today. It's not up enough, even though it was up strongly yesterday. I don't think people have spent enough time going through what Jensen had to say. They'd buy the stock and pay even more, given the fact he had a huge upside surprise, even though the numbers were extraordinarily strong. The estimates were high. So, David, it's not done. NVIDIA's not done.
It's not done. And at the same time, do you continue to have a cautious, sort of more cautious view towards Intel, tempering some of those expectations about a big comeback anytime soon?
Pat Gelsinger's been adamant that Intel's doing much better than people think, and it's not an expensive stock, but look, if NVIDIA's coming in after you, if you stay bullish about your own prospects, that's tough. Because Jensen's been known to destroy a market when he comes in. And you'll see all the gaming stocks fly, by the way, because he was so bullish on gaming that you just have to believe. And Carl, people are gaming like mad, even if the economy opens. NVIDIA goes higher.
Yep. Cowen today goes to 675. Wells goes to 715. Jim, you talked about gaming. Obviously, data centers are a huge story over there. And then Jensen did talk about the car industry, too. Take a listen.
The car industry has become a technology industry. Future cars are going to be completely programmable computers, and business models are going to be software driven. Car companies will offer software services for the life of the car. The new tech mindset sees the car not just as a product to sell, but as an install base of tens or hundreds of millions to build upon. creating billions in services opportunities.
So, Jim, we have that. And then we have Gelsinger himself at Intel talking about the degree to which Intel might help out the auto industry within 6 to 9 months, he said.
Look, I think that meeting with the president came at the end of the meeting. He was only there for just a few minutes. I think the takeaway of that meeting at the White House was these companies are really in trouble. They're not going to get any of the, they're just going to get the scraps. Chinese are hoarding chips. The attempt to be able to make more chips in this country is talking about 2 to 3 years. I love the fact that Intel said it can help out. But, you know, Carl, you can help out. I can help out. David can help out. I mean, it's a little idle. We don't have the capacity. So we should just accept the fact that GM and Ford have to their numbers are not going to come in. There's going to be the layoffs are going to continue. There's a lot of other industries are hurt. The auto industry in particular just doesn't have chips that they had chips that were really an afterthought for the big makers. And the Chinese didn't regard us an afterthought. There is not enough talk about how the Chinese took everything they need. And by the way, this is the same process that they took all the PPE. They're just very forward thinking. This was not designed to thwart the U.S., Carl. But the fact is that they were worried about running out of chips, and we weren't. We were not in touch with the industry. I blame our car companies. I think they weren't visionaries at all. They were focused on other things. They got to start focusing on chips. They may have to build their own foundries. It wouldn't shock me.
What?
Well, although, Jim, if you listen to what Huawei said yesterday, and you look at some of the charts of Chinese production after they got named to the entity list, the general view in China, it appears, is that once we started really targeting them through things like entity lists, that's when they started hoarding. I mean, I guess, can you blame them?
No, not at all. And we do just in time. They do just in case. They were very smart. It's almost like that they were regarding this as strategic. But the fact is, they sell a lot of cars there. And they did what I think we used to do, which is say, hey, look, business is really good. Let's stockpile. Don't forget, GM and Ford thought the business was going to be really bad. They made a major strategic mistake. So now they're paying for it. By the way, their used car market is going insane. I think that we're going to see used car trucks maybe trade through what you can get pay for a new truck because you can't get a new truck. So I think that this was the fault of the auto companies being just a terrible read of their own situation and not knowing their own supply chain. I think they literally did not know what this market was like, the people at the top. And it's a shame because I think they pretty much regret their situation right now. David, that there was not a lot of foresight, and the Chinese had the foresight and we didn't.
Yeah, well, I'll take the other side of the bet that automakers are going to start their own foundries. That seems unlikely to me. But interesting. It's an interesting thought.
Interesting thought? Well, it was the thought that was talked about.
Yeah, but really? Is that a core competency? And we're going to start making chips for our, I mean, really? Come on. That's
okay.
Not going to happen.
Well, what are you saying that I made it up?
No, I'm
I mean,
not,
I did all
I
this reporting on it. You think I made it up?
No, of course not. I don't think you made it up. I'm just
remember what I said.
I'm just
every kiss
the
begins with favor
of that as an outcome.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, yes. I think that the idea that they're not the Defense Department, which had to be, has to be able to do its own thing. I do think that it was discussed. What do we do as part of this National Foundry Initiative? But David, I mean, the foundries, they all begin with KLA. They begin with Lam Research. OK, they begin with Applied Materials. Applied Materials does not have a shortage, but they can make the machines they need. But Lam Research, they are so overordered that I think that we should stop thinking about buildings and start thinking about what's in the buildings, David. And it's Lam Research product and Lam can't make enough. So can we just own that and move on?
Okay, I own it, and I'm moving on. I'm going to move on to Nuance, the deal from yesterday, guys. Just want to mention it because, we got the background of the transaction, and it's always interesting to see. These are one of the larger deals of this year, of course, as we know, almost $20 billion when you include debt. Microsoft started at $53.50. That was their first offer, and they only went up to $56, and that's where they got the deal done. And I mention it because, listen, these things typically amount to much, and that most likely will be the case here. You only need a majority to vote in favor. But, Jim, there are a number of shareholders I talked to who are somewhat disappointed with the price. And yesterday, when John Ford asked the CEO of Nuance about it, well, take a listen to his answer.
We just saw an opportunity to really, you know, to create hyperscaling opportunities on a global basis. And, you know, we're purpose driven here at Nuance, very similarly to Microsoft. We believe we can create more access to care. And we believe that is a great calling for the two companies to come together for.
You know, that means nothing to a current Nuance shareholder who's getting 56 in cash. They're not really interested in what it's going to mean for the company after this. Certainly for that gentleman who's going to be continue to be the CEO, for employees, important. But for shareholders who are looking at 56 and saying, well, maybe we could have just hung in there and done better over time. It's an interesting question, particularly because, of course, it is all cash. So we'll keep an eye on it, Jim.
David, they own this market. They had both Epic and Cerner. That's the duopoly that has all our records. It's really incredible how little they got for this one.
So you agree? You question?
Oh my God! You can't get this information. They had a deal with these two companies. One of them's private, and it was never going to sell. I mean, this was the back door to get into the information. David, I'm going to use a technical term that you rarely do. You rarely use. The Nuance shareholders, they were pantsed.
Pantsed. I knew you were going there.
Pantsed. That's a technical term.
It is a technical term, Carl. Listen, you know, as I said, it's very rare that you actually see opposition mount to be able to vote a deal down or in some way. Icon was in the stock many years ago. But, Carl, interesting to note, and again, we never got that answer from the CEO as to why 56 was the appropriate number to take in terms of an all-cash transaction. Over to you.
Yeah, there's always next time, guys. For the meantime, you got J&J at about a one-month low, and we'll keep our eye on what obviously banks are trailing today. Let's get to Bob Pisani. Hey, Bob.
Good morning, guys. An awful lot of news today, but is any of it really market moving? And the market's saying, no, not really. And that may be a surprise to a lot of people. Let's just look at the sectors and what's moving. Tech's having a good day. All the mega cap tech names and mega cap semis are on the upside. Consumer discretionary is up. Tesla's up. Amazon's having a good day. Modest weakness in industrials, modest weakness in banks. That's not unusual going into earnings season. Remember, banks are the first reporters. You typically get a little bit of a dip. So nothing terribly surprising. Kind of flat on the open. Yes, the reopening plays are down a little, so you have 1-2% declines in the cruise lines, for example, 1-2% declines in the airlines, but that's not much. These are high beta names these days, folks, and that's not terribly surprising, that decline. In fact, it's pretty modest. Yes, you have a small uptick in the stay-at-home, work-from-home names, the Pelotons of the world, the Zooms, Electronic Arts, for example. But it's not much. Again, these are high beta names as well. And so 1% moves, 2% moves, that's not at all unusual. I call that fairly flattish. So what is moving the markets right now? I think the important thing is that this is a bit of a wild card on Johnson & Johnson, but maybe not as much as people think. Maybe a modest impact on confidence, maybe on the timing of the reopening a little bit, but it doesn't seem to have broader implications on the other vaccines and the other rollouts of those vaccines. The inflation number is very interesting today on the CPI, very modestly higher CPI, but not far from in line. Higher but manageable is what I keep hearing about it, and priced into the market there. Again, another big headline number, not impacting the markets. Earnings is what I follow, and boy, the expectations are high, folks, really high, maybe too high. It's been difficult to get stocks to rally on good numbers in the last few months on the prior earnings season. I'll have a lot more to say about that, but that is my primary concern. In terms of what's moving, what everyone's talking about on the trading desk, boy, it's still about that crypto. And I cannot believe the impact people think Coinbase is going to have. Let me just show you this valuation estimates. I've been trying to get my hands around the valuation. Nobody seems to get it. I've seen $50 billion, $100 billion, $200 billion valuation. We got a pre-IPO price of $343 floating around, 196 million shares. That's 67 million. MKM is using that. That seems like a good number right now. But think about this. NASDAQ's valued at $25 billion. The NYSE and ICE, the whole ecosystem that the ICE has, is $68 billion. Is the market saying that the Coinbase valuation is worth as much as ICE and the NYSE? It seems to be. That's kind of remarkable. What you're going to see here is enormous amounts of buying, because this is going to create a whole new group of people that are going to want to get in to the whole crypto asset base. So you're going to see big ETF buyers out there, certainly the IPO ETF, Cathie Wood's ARK FinTech ETF, as well as some of the other ones that are out there. Guys, there's also the Bitcoin ETF floating out there. And I think with a new SEC commissioner, there's going to be a new impetus behind that as well. Guys, back to you.
All right, Bob, thanks for that. Yeah, everybody's on the lookout for that. Bob Pisani. Let's get to Rick Santelli on what was an important day for consumer inflation. Hey, Rick.
Hello, Carl. And indeed, we could all just pass off inflation. Yes, the year-over-year numbers, which is what many were expecting would be a little hotter, really weren't. But that doesn't mean the numbers weren't warm. If you look at the headline up 6/10, you have to go all the way back to June of 2009 to find a larger number month over month, which was 8/10, as you see on that chart. But there was an awful lot of volatility today, and it wasn't only at 8:30 Eastern, as you see on this intraday 10. Right there at 7 a.m. Eastern, what was the headline? J&J. J&J was the headline. Now, we could all say that it didn't make a huge difference, but it did. Okay, interest rates saw that headline, immediately went lower, and after the data was out, we're back down. We're at 165. Now, that's not huge. We're down a couple of basis points, but we seem to be following the Dow and the NASDAQ. NASDAQ's doing the opposite of interest rates. Rates have gone down. NASDAQ's a little peppier this morning. And if you open that 10-year chart up to early March, you can see that until we start to settle under 160, 161, this is just going to stay somewhat solid, and most are going to continue to think that interest rates on a knee-jerk move are going to be more apt to be higher rather than lower. On foreign exchange, the euro currency is really starting to do better against many other currencies. Now, if you look at the Chinese currency, the euro versus the yuan, what you'll see is it really has turned up. It's had a very nice end of March, early April. And if you look at how it's doing against the yen, it's almost at a 2.5-year high. Just a few days ago, it was at the highest levels since 2018, maybe around October, but we're not far from that level, as you see on the chart. And finally, all of that, of course, has taken out some of the steam on the dollar index. Now, here's a chart that goes back 2 weeks, okay, to early April, and you can clearly see if we start to spend any more time under 92 even, and we have briefly today, that is going to take the technical wind out of the sails of the upside of the dollar index. Carl, Jim, David, back to you.
All right, Rick, thank you. Rick Santelli. So to start this Tuesday morning, you got some Apple, Fang, stocks doing well, Tesla, some semis in there, lagging this morning, definitely the airlines, some retail, some credit cards, some cruise lines. We're back in a minute. We've got the CDC FDA press conference about J&J in a few moments. But in the meantime, getting a statement now from the White House COVID response coordinator, Jeff Zients, Jim, who says that the J&J pause, quote, will not have a significant impact on our vaccination plan. In fact, he says that so far J&J makes up less than 5% of the recorded shots and arms in the United States to date.
Yeah, I mean, it's very discouraging at J&J. First, I thought that they were going to make a lot themselves, but they sent it to Emergent Bio, which is a place that really has, obviously, the technology is not so great. But more important, Carl, Moderna and Pfizer are in charge of this. J&J is really an asterisk. So let's get serious and recognize that J&J was only going to be able to send 4 million vaccines from the Netherlands. Not enough to impact anything. Drop in the bucket. So, look, I feel bad that what's happening. I do think that it's no worse than a flu shot. But J&J was not the factor. They just haven't been able to deliver. Extremely disappointing, Carl. Extremely.
Shares are off the lows, as you can see. But as we said earlier, about a one-month low on J&J. We will get stopped trading with Jim after a short break. Let's get stopped trading with Jim.
All right. There's a company that's $171 billion. Nobody knows it. It's called Danaher. They actually, a couple years ago, bought the healthcare, the high growth healthcare part of GE. GE, Larry Culp used to run Danaher. Larry Culp runs GE. He knew the value of it. He wanted the money. This stock is not going to stop at 241. That's crazy. The analysts, it pre-announced this morning, all the analysts have to raise the price target. Look out. This one is going substantially higher from where it is right now. Danaher.
Wow. Look at that chart, which we paid a lot of attention to, Jim, when Culp went to GE.
Yep.
Danaher's a winner. And boy, I got to tell you, I know Larry had to sell it, but this you're talking about 57% growth for this $170 billion company. Will you give me a break? How can this stock only be up 7 points? Tomorrow, it's going to be up another 15 as every analyst hops on it. They all have to raise numbers.
Yeah.
They do.
Amazing.
A lot of bullish calls on industrials. I see there was a buy signal over at Deutsche on Honeywell this morning, Jim. Well, watch that. What's on Mad tonight?
Yes. All right. Well, we have the only analysis that you need from Coinbase. We're going to give you what Coinbase is really worth. And we also have our old friend Ron Shake talking about PAR Technology, a company he invested in. But if you want to know what to do with Coinbase, watch us. Because Ben Stotto, who's research director, has been working furiously on the valuation. We've been incorporating Lisa Ellis's work from excellent work from Moffitt Nathanson. I cannot wait to talk about Coinbase and what it means.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to sort of get into what they're all about, especially tomorrow, Jim. We'll see you tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern, Mad Money
okay.
with Jim Cramer.
Thank you. You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.